Good morning. It's Saturday, February 7th, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with the writer Shu Si. Shu Si is the author of 7 books of fiction and essays and editor of 3 anthologies of Hong Kong literature in English. A Chinese-Indonesian native of Hong Kong, the city was home until her mid-20s, after which she led a peripatetic existence around Europe, America, and Asia. Her most recent book, Evanescent Isles, has been called an unusual book of quirky essays written from her city village about Hong Kong's vanishing culture and sensibility as it transforms into a space that is 21st century China. The book is part cultural observation, part memoir. Shu Si has won an O. Henry Prize, a Cohen Award from Plowshares for Best Story, an NYFA Fiction Fellowship, and the South China Morning Post Story Contest, among others. Her work has also occupied the shortlist for the inaugural Man Asian Literary Award. She's on the faculty at Vermont College MFA in Writing Program. And in 2009, she will be the Bedell Distinguished Visiting Writer at the University of Iowa's Nonfiction Program. When I spoke to Shu Si in December, I asked her to talk about the inspiration for her new book, Evanescent Isles.
The original image that sort of inspired me was I was traveling across the Star Ferry one day, and I think I write about this in the book, and I see the image that is on the front cover, which is one of the buildings, the IFC building in Hong Kong. And it was like a very misty day, a very polluted day, and I'm watching it vanish into the clouds. And it reminded me of this painting I had seen some years back by Henry Brookman, a Danish painter, of the Sorrento coast. And I thought about it as a kind of vanishing image, you know, and that was sort of one of the things that got me thinking about Hong Kong in that way, because, of course, ever since the handover, we're now, you know, legally the special administrative region of China, but we're on a kind of 50-year lease now. And we've always been on a lease. You know, Hong Kong's entire history is that of being a kind of leased land or borrowed land, and that's what we are now. And you can see the culture changing, the culture that was before disappearing, so that it's becoming more Chinese. And it's understandable since our sovereign ruler is China. But of course, Hong Kong's culture is a very unusual one. Mm. It's a kind of moment out of time, sliced out of history, and it will probably not survive the way it is. And that's just going to be its fate, probably, you know?
Yeah. Now, how quickly is that happening, do you think?
Well, I think in our own lifetimes, it feels not that quick. But in the scope of historical time, it's, you know, it's a blink. It's nothing.
Right.
I mean, we're only like 150 years old, and now, you know, we'll have another 50 years, and that's it. Which is nothing. Absolutely nothing. And of course, if, you know, when you think about China as the sort of cultural heritage from which we come, it's, you know, the 4,000-year history. So, you know, in the space of that, what we are seems very small. But we are small but unusual, and it is a sort of historical anomaly that happened to China.
Mm-hmm. Early in the book, you mentioned that these stories that you wanted to write to put together this collection, whatever it was going to be, needed to tell more than show. And that, in part, is why you chose to write essays rather than fiction. So I wonder if you can talk about that decision a little bit.
Well, I mean, of course, show, don't tell is what we're always teaching our fiction students. And to a great extent, too, I mean, good creative nonfiction also incorporates a lot of the show, don't tell. But the essay form does allow you to tell with a certain amount of exposition, although certainly the telling should still be dramatic, should still have specific examples and all the rest of it. But it allows you to sort of just put across a point of view, or simply just tell some of the facts that are there. Something that you wouldn't do in fiction as much.
Right.
Because even if you're, say, describing a place in a story or a novel or something, you want to get the setting for the place, and a lot of the description can be a form of telling, it still requires you to have something happening so that the forward movement of the narrative or the characters involved in it will not be just sort of left out of the picture, at least in contemporary fiction. I mean, I think there was the 19th century had more tolerance for that, probably this sort of atmospheric kind of thing. But in an essay, you do have a little bit more freedom, I think, to talk about factual things. It could be issues of politics or history or whatever that mm-hmm. I wanted to include, or mm-hmm. something about the social setting.
Or, for example, the glossary that you put
the glossary,
in at a certain
well,
point,
that's
which was fun.
A bit of a joke, yeah. But also that was paying homage to the sort of linguistic question that is true if you're going to write in English from what is essentially a non-English speaking space.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, although English is one of our sort of official language, it is not the language of the people.
I enjoyed the translation of the warning in the subway to mind the gap,
yeah.
Or the specific translation was, please have a little heart for the crack in space from the train to the platform.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked that you turned that crack into a metaphor, you know, mm-hmm. for Hong Kong's space in world history. Can you talk a little bit about how did that must have just occurred to you on the train one day?
I was on the train and I kept thinking about the character that was used, and I thought, you know, that's such kind of an odd character. What does it really mean? So I went to the dictionary to see. I understood that it meant gap. But, you know, like a lot of Chinese characters, they, you know, a lot of terms are two characters combined or four characters combined, things like that. But the individual characters also have meanings of their own. So I went back to the dictionary to say, what does this word really mean? And it actually has a geographical terminology about a crack that you, in talking, you know, in a geological or geographical setting, you can refer to it as a crack, like in a landscape or something like that, where the earth kind of fissures open or something like that. So I thought, crack. Crack sounds a lot better than just gap. You know, crack suddenly starts to feel jagged and a little painful, a little bit more rough. And a little bit more violent, too.
Mm.
And that's what I was thinking of. I thought, it's a crack in space, not just a little gap, you know?
Right.
And when you start thinking about the crack seems to have motion and movement of its own. And that's what made me think of it and to use it this way. And people who know Chinese and who've heard me use this, read from the book and say the crack in space, always laugh because they recognize the truth of what I say, that it's a creative translation. Because technically you would not translate it like that, but it did have that additional meaning.
Right. It must be particularly enjoyable for you to work with language because you speak mm-hmm. multiple languages, but also you read multiple alphabets, and that's
mm-hmm.
fascinating.
Yeah.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you're writing, do you ever have a Chinese word that would be the perfect word for what mm-hmm. you want to put across, and
there's just no English word for it.
That's probably.
So I've learned now just to put the Chinese word in. I had to figure out how do you put Chinese words in? How do you put Chinese into English? In some ways, it was easier to do French, even though my French is not far from fluent. I mean, I speak Chinese much better than I speak French. But it was easier to do the French to sort of lay a French in, because there's more of a tradition of that already in English language writing,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. You wrote about your own personal history in mm-hmm. Evanescent Isles. Was that hard for you?
A little bit, because I wasn't used to doing it. The first piece I actually ever wrote that was somewhat more personal was the one called Conversation Space that appears later in the book,
mm-hmm.
where I talk about my father and this friend of mine. And that was kind of the breakthrough piece. I wrote it long before I even thought about putting a book together. And that was my first experience of, oh my God, I'm writing CNF or an essay, the way I write fiction, that nobody's telling me to write this. I'm just writing it. Because up to that point, most of the nonfiction I wrote, and even in my last book, which has essays and stories, a collection, is a mixed genre collection, most of those essays were things that came from, you know, many were edited for the book, but they were originally something that I was commissioned to write.
Mm.
And that was the only reason I ever wrote nonfiction, was because some editor said, hey, would you like to do a piece on X, you know?
Mm.
But now I was actually just doing it. I was just writing it. It just seemed to come to me that way. And when that happened, I thought, wow, you know, maybe this is something I could write about. And that's what gave me the idea of the book, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's after I'd written a few pieces along those lines that I started thinking on those in those terms. Prior to that, it never occurred to me that I would ever do a complete book of creative nonfiction.
Right. And it is such an interlinking of your own personal story and
yeah.
the story of your place.
Of city, yeah.
I found your observations about forgiveness to be interesting. In talking about a painful memory of a betrayal of a sort on your father's part, you write that you don't believe in the forgiveness of sins because mm-hmm. forgiveness is up to heroes and gods and not mortals.
That's right.
I very much enjoyed that, and I mm-hmm. wondered if you could talk about that a tiny bit.
Well, I'm basically a lapsed Catholic. You know? I was raised Catholic. My mother was very Catholic. She was a convert. And my father became Catholic to marry her, essentially. And we all were brought up to go to church, and we went to Catholic school and all the rest of it. But there was always the example of my father who kind of stood on the periphery of the church. He never could get through an entire mass. He was always outside smoking a cigarette or something, you know. And I think having these sort of contradictory kind of images in my life about what Catholicism meant, even though I was trying to be a pious, good little girl, you know, didn't last, you know. And today I'm not a practicing Catholic. I have a lot of respect for religion and the Catholic religion, but I just don't feel it inside myself. And one of the things is this sort of all-forgiving kind of martyr-like attitude, which seems so terribly godlike. And in most cases, if I look around, when I think about the people I know who talk about being forgiving and all that, but still hang on to a great deal of bitterness. Mm. My mother's a good example of that. It makes me wonder. It's like, well, you know, it makes me question Catholicism as right. Where people just are hanging on to the rituals of it and not the true meaning of Christianity, which I think is very wonderful, actually. But no, I don't really believe we really sort of forgive. We just make peace with it somehow, and it no longer matters anymore. In a way, my father's betrayal now doesn't matter to me. In some ways, even though a long time ago I forgave my mother, so to speak, in that I thought, okay, she was sort of trying to do the best thing for me, even though I think she was incredibly misguided, it's not the same to say you forgive someone doesn't mean you necessarily make peace with it. It took me a lot longer to make peace with my mother, whereas I didn't have as much trouble making peace with my father.
Right. Now, did you find yourself working through some of that as you wrote the essay, or had you already gotten to that point?
No, I was working through it. I think the writing does help you come to terms with some of it.
Yeah.
Because I had never actually approached the question of who was really to blame, so to speak. Not that I'm blaming either of my parents, but in a way, although for years and years I always said, well, my mother was the one who forced me to do this, my father could have done something about it.
Yeah.
And I never actually approached that question because I was probably my father's daughter, if you like. I was much more, you know, in his image, so to speak, and I felt always much closer to him. But it was a massive betrayal,
right? And we should explain that you were basically forced to study
science, yeah, which I didn't want to, yeah. Clearly inclined to the arts, even my teachers and my principal wanted me to do that, you know,
right. Did you write fiction as you were working on this?
Yeah. I never stopped, pretty much. Although there were moments, of course, when I was, especially close to the end of the book or trying to complete the manuscript and things like that, where I had to put aside the other writing and just
because
focus
of deadlines.
On this. Yeah.
I enjoyed your description of the old Hong Kong airport, Kai Tak.
Kai Tak.
Because I've heard stories about what it was like to land there and how it was very frightening.
Hair-raising.
In that section, you say that the residents of Hong Kong had stopped using the term colony to describe mm-hmm. their status 2 decades before British rule ended, because even the pretense of self-determination was preferable to none at all.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that sentence, that the pretense of self-determination was preferable. Did that come through in other aspects of life in Hong Kong?
Yes, because, you know, by the 70s and 80s, Hong Kong had become, was going through its economic, you know, sort of surge forward. By the 90s, we were a very wealthy kind of city. Because the Hong Kong I grew up in was poor, and the Hong Kong that I watch change became its very first world place. And part of that is due to the fact that we have a kind of free society. It's certainly a capitalist marketplace. And the appearance of a kind of democratic sort of space. But of course, there is no democracy in Hong Kong. There never has been. We could vote for the people who, you know, worried about things like how the garbage got picked up. But we couldn't vote for anybody who made any real policy. And all the legislative policy and all the legal sort of jurisdiction in Hong Kong, that was all sort of, it came down to us from Britain. We had very little to do with it.
Mm.
But by the same token, as as Hong Kong people became more educated and started to step into civil service positions, a lot more local people had power and could help to make policy and to help to shape the future of Hong Kong. And so we saw what seemed like a form of self-determination. But it's not very different from the old comprador situation. In China, it was always like the person who could kind of negotiate between the foreign power and the colonized power.
And sort of a liaison.
A liaison person.
Okay.
And in a way, our civil servants were a kind of comprador, because they did the bidding of Britain, so to speak. Mm. And because they could speak English, they could deal with the Western world. And they could, they were often educated in England or in America or places like that. So you could say they were sort of half Westernized. So something like me in a way, although I wasn't in government, but I am one of these in-between people.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a privileged class in a sense. But it doesn't mean that it really reflects what most people would feel or believe.
Right.
Because
yeah.
most people speak Cantonese and have a very different life.
Now you indicate that the majority of Hong Kong residents are somewhat ambivalent about their changing city.
I think so.
Yeah.
Not all would agree with me, but I think they are.
Why do you say that, and how might they disagree with you?
Well, we have political parties in Hong Kong. We have some who are clearly on the Chinese side, and they're clearly sort of very much in sympathy with China and that kind of thinking. We have the more radical fringe who are pushing for a more democratic kind of government, who believe in a kind of, not exactly self-rule, but at least more self-determination about what Hong Kong people should have. So they're on the other end, and then we have the people in between. And the people in between are probably a majority.
Mm.
And they're the ones who are ambivalent. And I'm part of that, I think. because it's not so easy to say, oh, we are all Chinese, and that we're happy to live with the rules of, with the laws of China. Because we actually have a separate legal system in Hong Kong. A separate financial system, a separate monetary, everything. Whereas other people who are on the other end, on the China end, would be very pro-China, would be quite happy to go over to the Chinese side. So I think the ambivalence comes from the fact that you can't deny that China is our ruler and that we are Chinese.
Mm.
But on the other hand, we're not the same kind of Chinese as the Chinese on the mainland, and that's the difficulty.
Mm.
And most Hong Kong people have a hard time with the fact that there are increasingly more Chinese from the mainland coming into Hong Kong to work, to go to our schools, to go to our universities. And there's a real distinct difference in culture.
Mm-hmm. This might be a good time for you to read from Evanescent Isles.
I could just read from the opening, the preface. Yeah.
Great. So this is Shu Si reading from Evanescent Isles, which was published by
Hong Kong University Press. So this is from the preface. Visitors in my city hear this announcement. Please mind the gap between the train and the platform. The tone is feminine and formal. The accent surfs the waves of English that is the Queen's, American Global, and Canto Local. It cautions riders of the MTR, the people's name for the mass transit railway, our metro, subway, tube, underground, as you pull into each station. What fewer visitors comprehend is the preceding Cantonese announcement. 请小心列车与月台间之空隙. Please have a little heart for the crack in space from the train to the platform, which is a creative but not entirely unrecognizable translation. Hong Kong occupies a tiny crack in the space of world history. We were that barren isle sacrificed by China and disdained by England, but we flourish like some unstoppable weed in our borrowed space and time. In 1939, the poet W.H. Auden observed of the city, "Here in the east, the bankers have erected a worthy temple to the comic muse." Now that his century is past, it is perhaps time to reflect on the worth of that temple, this place I'll call home for as long as it makes me laugh and sing and feel. We have become a cosmopolitan people, though still undeniably a brand of Chinese, who trade in the languages and commodities of the world. To be a Hong Kong citizen allows you to absorb the best of East and more East, and to know the nuance of West versus East if you choose. Do the twain really meet? Occasionally, yes, but perhaps more often, no. Our children marry across races and produce offspring in multiple hues who are not lost in translation, unlike cosmopolitans from the West. Yet you will find Chinese traditions and attitudes dating back hundreds of years, nascent in this post-postmodern space. Our public holidays and festivals cling to old myths and superstitions long abandoned in modern China. We like to insist our contemporary culture is less global, westernized, democratic, and confused than it really is.
Thanks very much. At one point in the book, you include essays written under the pseudonym Long Hei, which means dragon's breath. Why use a pseudonym, first of all? And also, do writers in Hong Kong need to be careful about the subject matter they address?
To address the first question, part of that is borrowing on a Chinese tradition. The Chinese newspapers in Hong Kong have always published kind of short stories and critical essays, and essays is a big form in Hong Kong. And it's fairly typical for a lot of Hong Kong Chinese, the Chinese writers do adopt a pen name, although everybody knows who they are, but they still adopt a pen name. And I kind of thought it would be interesting, since these were sort of like op-eds, they were pretend op-eds set at different times, you know, over different points in time, to try to write some of those and use a pen name of sorts, except that this would be an English language one, which was kind of a perversion of what we actually have in Hong Kong. So yes, that was part of it. I was like playing with that idea, because that comes directly out of our culture. But the other side of it, well, Hong Kong still has essentially a free press. We are not sort of censored quite the way China is. However, I think it's fair to say that for a good 15, 20 years or so, the press has become increasingly more restrained. Mm. It is still a much freer press than China. And while in China, for example, it would be a lot harder to write about Tibet, it would be a lot harder to write about the Muslim insurgents in the West than part of China, or you still get people regularly thrown into jail for being too vocal. And this is going on even right now as we're talking. In fact, every day when I look in the press, there's something about it. Hong Kong press can still report all of that, and the journalist will not be censored, will not be thrown into jail, etc. So we have a freer press. But it is changing, and this is one of those issues that Hong Kong has to address, that in China it's one way and in Hong Kong it's another. Now, what does this mean for us? Mm-hmm. Some of our legislators cannot get into China that easily because they are too vocal about democracy or about things going on in China that they would like to criticize. You do not talk about Tiananmen in China. We can talk about Tiananmen in Hong Kong. When Tiananmen happened, about 1 million people in Hong Kong marched in protest. So that gives you an idea. And for years after that, there were vigils every June 4th to commemorate Tiananmen. Now, that doesn't happen in China. So, I mean, these are just some ways that we are different, mm-hmm. and yet we are still Chinese. So,
one of the essays concerns Hong Kong's absence of a native literature. Mm-hmm. I found that very interesting.
We do have, of course, Hong Kong Chinese writers, and we have some Hong Kong English writers. But each of us, now the Chinese writers are, of course, much bigger than the English language literature. But let's talk about the Chinese language literature. First of all, we have writers who are wonderful poets, fiction writers, you name it, and all the genres. But they do sit there in the shadow of China. Mm-hmm. And in the shadow of Taiwan, I should add. Hong Kong was late coming to the literary sort of table, partly because we were poorer and had to, you know, sort of establish ourselves, and we were just like this little city colony. Partly because we were a British colony, so there was no incentive, there was no sort of cultural kind of, not need, but desire perhaps, certainly not by the ruling classes, to have a literature created. And the kind of Chinese writing that comes out of Hong Kong is very peculiar to the Cantonese language, first of all, which is not the main language of China, which is Mandarin in China. And Hong Kong has its own brand of slang and its own brand of sort of dialect, you know, in Hong Kong. And so that all informs the literature. Mm-hmm. And it also, most of all, though, it has its own perspective and its own way of viewing the world. And so our literature is kind of like this, the literature of a small place. Okay? The same thing for English. And in English, it's even more marginalized, since, after all, why would you write in English if that's not the primary language? But there are people like myself who came from kind of mixed circumstances. I'm from a Chinese-Indonesian background, who had reason to make English our first language more than Cantonese, and who are not Cantonese. I am not. I'm Fujianese. I'm not Cantonese. Mm-hmm. So we were kind of marginal and a little bit odd in Hong Kong. And some of us gravitated towards the study of English literature. And so for that reason, what you would call a native literature of Hong Kong is a little hard to come by still. Mm-hmm. And we still have arguments, is there a Hong Kong literature? Mm-hmm. Now, I have edited a couple of anthologies of Hong Kong writing in English. So that's a way of sort of saying that there's a form of literature and let's begin looking at it. But it was quite controversial the first time I did it. You know, yeah. I did it through the same university press that published Evanescent Isles. And not everybody will accept that that's any kind of literature worth paying attention to.
Now, was this essay controversial at all?
Yes, that was controversial, because it was originally presented as a paper at the University of Hong Kong. Now, the University of Hong Kong has an English department, and they asked me to... And, I've gone there, and I actually teach there right now, but I've gone there and given readings and things like that. But they have a seminar series like all English departments do. So I put in... this topic where I said, you know, that there was, is there a Hong Kong literature in English, you know, or why Hong Kong can't write, was the way I put it. And I proposed to study the life of this pop idol. He's the kid who was on American Idol, right, and, you know, became this pop star as a result, to talk about it. And, you know, English literature department seminars are usually attended by about 10 people, you know. That day, something like 50 people showed up. They all packed into the seminar room, and I was like, oh my God, you know, and I gave this paper. So yes, it did raise some controversy. It raised a lot of eyebrows. And after that, the local English language paper asked me for a kind of a truncated version of it. So I gave them a more sort of a condensed version of it. And then finally, I included it as an essay in this book. Yeah, of course, I edited it again, so it wasn't a paper anymore, but more like an essay, and included it there. But you see, this particular pop star, he also showed up at Hong Kong University, and 200 people showed up to his talk.
Oh, wow.
Yes, because he is kind of a phenomenon.
Yeah.
He's a cultural phenomenon.
It was a fun essay, that one, to read. Do you continue to rise at 4 every morning to write?
You know, it's sort of odd. I don't need to rise at 4 anymore. One of the reasons I did as a kid was because, I think I'm just an insomniac anyway, and most of my life I have done. Most of my life I've had a full-time job. Mm. And so the rising at 4 became a way to be able to write while you're doing something else. But I quit my full-time job something like 12 years ago, and now I'm teaching at Vermont, which is a part-time thing, and most of my life is sort of part-time work now. And so there's a lot less reason to get up at 4. So it's very distressing to me that I still do sometimes, you know. I don't do it as often. I've actually been able to, like, sleep longer. But it just sort of happens to me. I don't set the alarm clock to do this. It just happens.
Mm. Well, long habit, you know.
Yeah, and my body just doesn't need that much sleep.
What are you working on now?
Well, right now I'm trying to finish a novel, which I've been working on for a number of years. But in between, because I did this book and there was still this other novel that I was also revising, and short stories as well I was writing, somehow this particular book kept getting pushed by the wayside. Also, it's a book that it's the book I've had the most fun writing, more than any other novel I've ever written.
Wow.
I think it's because I like the characters very much in it. And I never had trouble liking all of the characters. Even the ones who were not very nice characters, I liked all of them more. At least I could empathize with all of them right from the get-go. Whereas some of the other novels I've written, I had to learn to make peace with some of these characters I didn't really like very much, but wanted to write their story. So that's what I'm currently trying. I'm almost done with it. I promised my agent it would be done at the end of last year, and I then said to her about 2 weeks before Christmas, I don't think it will be done. So,
do you have a working title?
For that book? Yeah, it's called That Man in Our Lives.
And
yeah.
Is that...
No, this is the other novel that
okay.
was... this actually was shortlisted for what we call the Asian Booker. Okay. There's a new prize. It's the Man Asian Literary Prize, and it was shortlisted for it last year. Oh. But that's for a book that's not yet published. It's a manuscript. So I had this manuscript, and it's been kind of going around publishers, and there is a Hong Kong publisher who's going to put it out in fall this year. At least I think it'll be fall, or I'm not sure exactly when, but later this year. And right now we're still looking for a co-publisher for it, and hopefully in America.
And what's this one called?
It's called Habit of a Foreign Sky, which is actually from an Emily Dickinson poem.
Oh. Yeah. Would you like to read some
yes,
of that?
Yes, I'll read you the opening of it.
That'd be great.
Okay. So this is from Habit of a Foreign Sky. Her maid, Conchita, told her. The call from Hong Kong woke Gail in New York at 3 a.m. For one, she was silent, unable to pass judgment. Ma'am? For a second, Conchita wondered if her mistress had fainted, but decided that no, it was the shock. The police said they probably died the moment the bus hit them. She paused. They must have. An image of her son flung into the air and slammed against the wall. Horrific. Yet even now, Gail's temper threatened to erupt. She checked herself, doing her best to confine herself to the facts. First unexplainable fact. Her mother and Gu Guan had crossed the harbor over to Kowloon, which surely was an unnecessary journey. Taking a deep breath, she said in a quiet voice, but why were they in Kowloon City, or even crossing To Kwa Wan Road? Everyone knows the traffic's dangerous around there with all the trucks. Conchita heard the familiar intake of air. Gu Guan said Grandma wanted to go home and he was going to bring her. I'm so sorry, ma'am. And then she began to weep. He was only 9. So unfair. I'm so very sorry for you, ma'am. Gail pressed her wrist against the back of her neck. The persistent headache of the last 2 days was migrating downwards. She wanted to shout across the world, how could you let him? Why didn't you stop? But the words froze in her throat. True responsibility was not Conchita's job. Thank you for calling, she said. I'll be back Sunday on the usual flight, and hung up. Holding onto the receiver, Conchita, crying, crossed herself. Gail opened the curtains and leant her tall frame against the pane. Through the dark, there was a distinct outline of the World Financial Center, which housed her employer's headquarters across the West Highway. She wanted to cry, but couldn't. Her thoughts skittered between her son and work. Yesterday, Gu Guan said that it had been very mo all day, mixing Cantonese into his English. When she pressed him to find the right word, he said, misty, to which she responded, it's because of the environmental pollution. Can you spell environment? And he had, correctly, pleasing her. Long-distance learning, false proximity, cheating her for the last time. Yesterday, when she should have been flying home instead of sleeping at the Marriott, but hadn't because of yet another round of meetings. Why couldn't? The protest cut itself short. She couldn't say no to management, could she? This unexpected trip wasn't her fault. There were no answers to this relentless travel, exaggerated since the middle of last year, because of the economic crisis. Last year, 1997, had been all about Hong Kong's handover. A pivotal year, said America's media, because the British were leaving and the Chinese taking over. Or so Wall Street feared. For Gail and her boss, it was tough enough persuading their investment bank's head office that Hong Kong wouldn't shut down on July 1st. Instead, it was July 2nd that proved pivotal, the day the Thai baht collapsed, followed rapidly by other Asian currencies, precipitating the regional economic crisis. Spreadsheets across the globe, which once forecasted strong growth in Asia, were shredded and recycled. Perplexed analysts from Wall Street to Central, with its views of Hong Kong Harbor, stumbled like dominoes. No more gold to be spun out of straw. For Gail and her boss, it meant exhausting travel as New York panicked, summoning them both to countless useless meetings at headquarters. Life turned upside down, 24 hours a day in 2 time zones. On top of her existing intra-Asian travel, she virtually lived in the air. Tightening belts and waiting for the inevitable turnaround was not the thing to say. Despite the fact that Hong Kong's currency was pegged to the US dollars, its economy suffered, perhaps from panic rather than from a true downturn. Across the border on the mainland, China preened as its economy continued to surge, robust, its currency firmly linked to America's. Meanwhile, a pale orange light disrobed the dark, revealing a clear and pristine sky. At 6, when Gail's wake-up call rang, she slammed the phone down so hard the receiver cracked. Later, she offered to pay for the damage. The front desk receptionist stopped his flurry of checkout activity. "I beg your pardon, Ms. Zito?" The way he said it sounded like Zito. "I broke your phone. Please charge the damage to my bill." "Please, just hurry. I'll sign an open receipt against my credit card if you want. I have to catch my flight." In the midst of her sorrow, she wondered about covering this unusual charge on expenses. "But I don't know. I mean, we have to check. Trust me, it's broken." Her voice sharp and a bit too loud. He was miffed now, unrelenting. "I understand, but this is so unusual that... Just do it, okay?" she shouted across the air at his smug countenance. The knuckles of her right hand jammed against the counter went white. A supervisor hurried over. "What appears to be the problem here?" Gail glared at the row of suited staff behind the counter. Her only family in the world was gone. They should understand and let her out of the city where she hadn't want to remain an extra night. She wanted to scream at their flustered incompetence, at their inability to handle anything slightly out of the ordinary. Instead, she removed her sunglasses and looked the receptionist in the eye. "I was rude. I apologize." Then she explained the charge problem to the supervisor, who made her wait another 10 minutes before it was resolved.
Thank you very much. It sounds like your feelings about Hong Kong were very much in the present, as you wrote that as well. Were you working on the two at the same time?
Kind of.
So what was the sort of inspiration for Gail's story?
Gail is a character from my previous novel, The Unwalled City. She was one of four characters that carried that novel through, which was very much a novel about the time before Hong Kong was handed back to China. And I was very interested in her. She's a Eurasian woman, a 40-something divorce investment banking person, high-powered sort of financial executive, and a single mother. But in the previous novel, I felt, she was just part of the story. And while I thought I sort of, rendered her in an interesting way, and she has a very unusual background also, kind of a secret background that she tries to hide, I found that there was a lot more of a story I wanted to tell. And in a way, this book is for my mother. Mm-hmm. My mother was, a very determined woman. She's the person who sort of made all her daughters go out and have careers and go on to college and made us all very determined. And so I wanted to write about a woman sort of like my mother, but in the present day and doing something completely different from what my mother would have had. Because part of the inspiration for that was the idea that my mother is a pharmacist, so as somebody from her day and age, she's 88 now, she was very unusual in that she went after a career. She actually wanted to be a doctor, but, the war and the circumstances of her education all that made it impossible for her to do that. So she became a pharmacist instead. But true to her time also, once she got married, it was kind of like, well, your dad wouldn't let me work, so, I stayed at home and looked after all of you. And so we were very privileged as children to have a stay-at-home mom. But really, a stay-at-home mom would probably have been happier if she was out working. But it was a very different time, It was very different, the circumstances for women before. So I kind of thought, there were two things I was thinking. I was thinking, one, what happens if a woman like this with so many responsibilities, in the way a woman like my mother, if all those responsibilities, as we understand it, are suddenly taken away, and in this case, her mother and her son, her only family really, get killed in this accident. And the next thing that happens is that her job disappears because the company is closed. She's the last person left, so she has to fire everyone. And it's kind of like when your whole world suddenly changes, and now the responsibility is just to yourself. And she's, of course, one of these self-sacrificing women who's just, she's this high power. She doesn't date. She doesn't do anything like that. Her husband left her for a younger woman, right. Or the classic sort of situation. And a situation I saw a great deal in Hong Kong.
So it's an interesting question, the idea of what happens to
what
a woman
happens
like this,
to a woman like this when everything's gone, when they no longer have those responsibilities and you just live for themselves. You see, as a woman myself who has never had children, who's always been able to do my life for me, so to speak, women's lives are interesting to me. And most women that I was around in the business world, they either had to be happily married and able to you know, sort of maintain all of that, or else they ended up divorced. And quite a high percentage of high-powered women are divorced. The other inspiration was a report I read years ago in the Wall Street Journal about Korean women. And it sort of tracked the lives of those women who had, you know, risen very high in corporate life. And I think over 50% were either divorced or never married. And I thought, yeah, that's it. You know, what happens to our lives, you know?
That's how it's allowed to happen.
That's how it's allowed to happen.
You mentioned that you have worked on one of these novels for quite a few years because you were...
Well, they both were worked on quite a few years. What was happening was I was actually working on the other novel I was talking about, whereas with Habit of a Foreign Sky, I was really in the final revision stage.
Okay.
I concurrently work on several things at one time, as you can tell.
Which makes me wonder about your revision process. How do you approach revision? Like, let's say you have a first draft and you're going to approach the revision of a novel. What will you do? How will you handle
that? First drafts are easy because actually writing the first draft is usually the thing that once you can get that draft down, then you kind of have something to begin from. And after that, it becomes draft after draft after draft. I put it aside for a little while, usually, and then I come back to it again. And generally, I if it's just the first draft, I probably rewrite it all over again.
The whole thing?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. It's bound to happen.
With your first copy at your elbow, or just from...
It depends. It's been a little different with every book. With this particular book, I wrote this book at several different residencies, which is kind of interesting, and in several different countries also. And it was a book that I was doing concurrently with several other... I was editing in a couple of anthologies at the time, too. So I had to sort of do that. That was sort of the right brain thing. And then I could do the creative thing here. And this was a book that I had... It was very difficult to write because the character was kind of based on my mother, and I have a difficult relationship with her, so that makes it even harder. And I didn't really like the character in some ways because I thought, you know, why did you have to have such a sort of restricted life? You restricted your own life, you know. But at the same time, I could feel sort of sorry for her, and I thought, this isn't going to work until I can empathize with her. Mm. So I had to kind of like get into her head, and that wasn't easy because she's so unlike me. I mean, she's like me insofar as, yes, I did work in, you know, business, and I had sort of a management job, so I understood that side of it. But I put her into a much more focused kind of career path. I mean, I was not nearly as focused. I knew at a certain point I was leaving it for writing, you know, whereas she has no such focus. Her focus is entirely her career and her son. And it was hard for me to think that way because it's like, I'm not a mother, you know. So I had to learn all those things and think about all that and get very deeply into that. So I just kept changing it and rewriting it and rewriting it until I felt I could get it right. But the interesting thing about this book was I got the opening pretty early on. I mean, it was developed and I had to sort of enrich it and make it... I had to sort of tighten it up and make it happen faster. But... it was one where I knew the opening was more or less the right direction for it right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
So most of it was fixing everything that came after that. So that's all I had to do, just the rest of it after that. But other books have been different.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
What are you reading now?
And that's interesting. I'm in the middle of one of Orhan Pamuk's novels, My Name is Red, which is about these miniaturist painters in, you know, in Turkey who, and it's a kind of murder mystery, although the murder mystery part is not the real point of it. The book is broken up into these tiny little chapters, just like tiny little miniature paintings, and each one are like beautiful little gems of their own, and you sort of builds up the story of all these different characters, and the characters repeat all the way through, and it's kind of interesting. So I'm halfway through that. And I'm also reading the Touchstone, rereading the Touchstone anthology of contemporary creative nonfiction, the one that Michael Martone and now I'm blanking on the name of the other editor, edited, because I'm actually going to Iowa, the University of Iowa, in a week or so, as their visiting nonfiction writer, and I'm using that as a textbook. So I wanted to reread the essays in there and think about how to do the lesson plan for the class.
What writers have influenced you, either personally or through their works?
A lot of different writers. Very, very early on, I would say that among the strongest influences were Marguerite Duras, the French writer, and also Doris Lessing. You know, these two writers were very influential to me early on. Duras' style particularly, because she's very spare and she does this dialogue that seems to float by itself, and she wrote a great deal about sexual matters, and of course when I was younger, like most young women, you want to write about sex, so I did, and I thought, hey, here's the person I can read to learn about writing about sex. With Doris Lessing, it was the scope of her work, you know, her novels and the way, you know, so much could happen. And I was very interested in how you, and also she wrote about Africa, how could you build worlds, you know, so she was very useful that way. But another major influence was also Nabokov, because he was somebody who wrote in English after having written in Russian for so long. And although I never have written in Chinese, I am influenced by another culture, and had to come and learn how to write sort of American, you know. And that was always, you were always making a choice linguistically, thinking about it, because so much of the English language world that was my influence was really British.
Right.
And so that was a big part of it. So those were among some of the earlier influences. But over the years, I mean, I love all kinds of writers. You know, Margaret Drabble is a great British novelist I like very much. And I've more recently come back to her again. I've been away from her for a while, and that was kind of nice. Jean Rees, for a long time, I read a lot of her work and really liked her.
Do you get feedback from anyone before you submit work?
Well, actually, Habit of a Foreign Sky, at one point, I had gotten the novel to about the third draft or something, and I thought, I want an editor to look at this. And I went to somebody privately to have them work on it. So I paid an editor to do it. And it was a very useful process.
Now, how did you find someone you trusted?
Well, I spent some time doing that. What I did was I actually took one of his workshops.
Yeah.
He had been an editor with some of the major, you know, publishing houses, and had edited all kinds of people. So he ran workshops. So I thought, okay, I'll just go and take one of his workshops and see what he's like. And I decided I liked his approach to reading literature and reading manuscripts. And so I contracted with him to have him work on that mid-process draft. Because I thought that's the best time to have someone look at it. And it really transformed the way I thought about the novel. And I went back in and I changed everything all over again, of course, you know. Very much in terms of perspective and point of view especially. And also in terms of, I added some characters as a result of thinking about it. Because the male character especially, because I had him read it and, you know, he found some problems with the male characterization that I had for one of the major male characters. So it made me think very hard about him, and I fleshed him out much more. And now I feel much happier with him as the sort of love interest character.
What advice do you have for writers who occasionally might get stuck in their work or have trouble with a piece that just refuses to move forward?
I just put it aside.
You just put it aside.
I really do, and work on something else.
Yeah.
Write something else. I mean, it could be something as mundane as writing an email, you know, just taking care of email or to a friend or something like that, you know, something that's a completely different thing. Or a journal, that's useful. I keep a journal with every novel I work on.
Oh, really?
And I just write in that journal. And that can be very free-flowing writing about the characters, about the problems that you're experiencing. And I find that actually unlocks it very often.
Now, are you fairly ritualistic about the journal, or do you just kind of pull it out whenever you feel like
it? I just pull out whenever I feel like it. Mm. There are times I am a little bit more ritualistic. Usually when I'm into a sort of a section where I'm generating a lot of new chapters. And that when I do that, I'm fairly sort of disciplined, and I'm working on it like daily, you know, sort of. And then I try to record what I've written and think about it. So that the next day I come back to it again and I read the chapter and then I look at the notes that I made about it. Mm. Because the notes are often rather helpful.
Oh, that's interesting. I haven't heard people saying that they do a journal for each particular work that they're...
And occasionally I even do it for short stories, not very often, but there have been some long or short stories that span a long period of time.
In your life?
In the arc. Of the story, the timeline of the story is a long period, and so it's hard to keep track of, and yet you want to condense it. So for those, sometimes I have done that.
That's good advice.
Yeah. Well, you write short story. You know, I do short stories as well. I go and write a short story.
Yeah. When your novel is stuck.
And figure out some detail of the novel through a short story. I do that, yeah.
Well, thank you very much for
thank
talking
you.
With me.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Xu Xi. Xu Xi's name is spelled X-U-X-I, two words. Tune in next week to hear an interview with Kate Harper and Leon Morasco, co-authors of the nonfiction book If Only I Could Tell You, Where Past Loves and Current Intimacy Meet. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. For more information, visit AutismSupportDaily.com or call 985-8773. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Xu Xi. She recommends borrowing an idea from jazz improvisation. Look at what Xu Xi calls the facts of the fiction and pick something to work with in your work. Improvise on it the way a musician might riff on a theme in music. See if the changes you come up with take the work in another direction. In the case of the novel Xu Xi read from in this interview, What If Gail's Child and His Grandmother weren't killed on page one, but later in the book? What if the phone conversation she remembers having with her son is a scene in the novel rather than a recollection? Or the other way around, what if a scene in your book could be a recollection? Might that make more sense? Move things around, riff on the facts in your fiction, and see what changes or comes unstuck. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live every Saturday morning at 9 at www.theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont.